CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world. Financial perspectives of tomorrow. Well, I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Welcome to CFO Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News comes to us published by CFO.com, entitled The New Talent Mix by David McCann. Finance chiefs are bolstering their strategic roles by hiring more financial planning and analysis help, FP&A help. And in this article, David McCann says, it's not news today that CFOs are more strategically oriented than many of their predecessors, but they are now trying to bring more of that analytical mindset to their staffs by adding more financial analysts than other types of finance positions. Compared with just 2 or 3 years ago, new hires are more likely to be financial planning and analysis, FP&A staffers, than technical accountants dedicated to financial reporting. Companies have also stepped up the training of existing and accounting and internal audit staff for redeployment to FP&A and manager accounting roles. For many organizations, factors driving the shift include a now well-oiled machinery for Sarbanes-Oxley compliance that needs less maintenance, and 3 years of economic turmoil that make creative growth strategies more crucial than ever. The article states, in the latest Duke University CFO Global Business Outlook survey, 48% of responding CFOs said that, given an opportunity to add headcount, they would most likely bulk up their FP&A staff. Only 31% said the same for accounting and financial reporting. To be sure, firms are still adding accountants, and finance departments are growing overall. More survey participants, 27%, said they've increased accounting staff over the past 2 years, then decreased it, 20%. But there is clearly a growing preference for those with broader business training. More than 2.5 times as many respondents, which was 16% in the survey, have added people with MBA degrees than subtracted them, which was 6%. Specifically, companies need finance people who not only bring analytical skills but also influencing skills. They also require staffers with the ability to work across functions and, most important, the confidence to be credible business advisors, says Jeff Thompson, president and CEO of the Institute of Management Accountants. The most desirable finance staffer, says Donald Kalinsky, CFO practice leader at recruiting firm DHR International, is a CPA who then gets an MBA. Such a person may be more able to advise on strategic matters, such as what projects should be funded, whether something should be acquired, built, or bought, and whether products or services should be eliminated. At Sandoz Pharmaceuticals North America, a $3.2 billion unit of healthcare giant Novartis, the number of people in the business planning and analysis department has grown 25% since 2008. That's good for the finance function, allowing it to be a bigger player in the firm's cross-functional development efforts. We now have a better seat at the table that lets us do our jobs better, says CFO James Master. Master's Group now has dedicated FP&A staff to support both business development and research and development. The former allows finance to be at the forefront of negotiations with its suppliers, for example. While business development might just want to go in and close a deal, we can tailor it to fit with our budget constraints and to what makes most sense in getting value from the agreement, Master says. The added financial analysis muscle helped the company score a big win in licensing contracts with drug companies. Historically, Sandoz, which distributes generic drugs, profited in the earlier part of the contract periods but often got stuck near the end with inventory that it had to sell for less. Now the contracts carry stop-loss clauses designed to prevent that scenario. No longer Sarbanes-Oxley boxed in is the next paragraph. At Worthington Industries, the internal audit department spent about 7 years focused heavily on perfecting internal controls for Sarbanes-Oxley compliance, says CFO Andy Rose. But by late 2008, the company was in good shape on that front, so it shifted the group's efforts to working more with business units on process improvements. Some people had to be trained, and the company eliminated 2 positions from its internal audit staff. At the same time, Worthington has doubled the number of people dedicated to mergers and acquisitions. The publicly held $2.5 billion metals manufacturer has made 7 acquisitions as well as 3 divestitures in the past 2 years. And thank you to CFO.com for that article. Well, today we're going to talk about ethics and lessons learned from a variety of different circles. And this comes from my experience talking to various different universities. As host of CFO Radio, I meet and interview CFOs on the radio show. But in my business day to day, one of the aspects of meeting and greeting and getting to that new customer, I have some expert knowledge and I speak at universities. The article that I'm going to present to you today on CFO Radio is one that I have spoken to a couple of times at the Goizueta Business School Emory University MBA program here in Atlanta, Georgia. And we're going to be talking about ethics. This is a very key component of the day-to-day business, not only for those in finance and accounting, but it is a very key component of us today in the world of business. I would note that this article is brought to you, it's an educational program brought to you by Delaney Learning. It is copyrighted by Delaney Consulting LLC with all rights reserved and no part of this publication may be reproduced. So we're going to start with a framework for the session. We're going to talk about the approach for thinking about ethics, number one. We're going to talk about examples and situations, number two. And then I'm going to leave you with some questions that in an MBA setting in the course environment, we go through and have a Q&A session, a question and answer session. What I'm going to do today throughout this framework and the presentation on ethics is we are going to leave questions for you to answer yourself. So let's give the ethics discussion a backdrop. In terms of CFO looking at their organization and in terms of you perhaps being a staff member in that organization, we need to understand that when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about corporate governance. And corporate governance these days is as much to do with ethics as it is about running the business. In other words, how you run the business. When we had Denny Beresford on our radio show, which was about 1.5 years ago. This is available by podcast. If you click on cforadio.com, you can go to the podcast versions and listen to Denny Beresford's article. He oversaw the audit committee for many companies and was former chairman of the FASB Standards Board, and he discussed corporate governance. Listen to that podcast and you'll hear a lot of dialogue about specific elements of that governance. The world's largest accounting fraud and bankruptcy. I was part of the turnaround for WorldCom and there are several lessons that I've learned from that. And again, talking as Lorraine Chilvers in my business career, I've been involved in many frauds and not from a personal perspective, except to help companies emerge from that fraud, to help companies emerge from bankruptcy. And the lessons learned are what I'm going to be talking about with you today. So let's start with WorldCom, the world's largest accounting fraud and bankruptcy. The accounting issues were $11 billion restatements plus. Fixed assets restatements were about $80 billion. And what was said was that the numbers were just too good to be true. And while this situation was of huge magnitude, just know from a listener perspective that this situation can happen in many small ways. So a question to you. You are the general manager of a plant. What do you do if you find a situation where the numbers are too good to be true? And that's something that I'll leave for you to think about. So the second aspect that we're going to talk about today, and the world's largest accounting fraud and bankruptcy, a quote that was said, the CFOs were very charismatic. And this is very often true in leaders that lead people to do the wrong thing, no matter whether it's an accounting fraud, a situation where there is a financial dispute, or whether this is something in a personal situation or one of wartime. The leaders are very, very charismatic, and they get people to do perhaps the unthinkable or the unfathomable because of their charisma, because of the fact that people trust them and believe in them. And we find this in many walks of life. So here's a question. What would you do if your best salesperson was known to be acting unethically? He or she is very charismatic and has a reason for all the quote-unquote luck. Their sales are twice that of any other salesperson. Upon investigation, you find, however, that the customers have not yet paid, and then you find out that much and many of the sales are bogus. Would you fire him or her, or would you give them a second chance? So here we go onto the CFO tip of the month in terms of this aspect of ethics. With all the challenges of liquidity and risk management, accounting is becoming extremely complicated. Having the right infrastructure, both in systems and people, are key. And that would be my CFO tip of the month with relation to this topic. So the question associated with that, is it a debate of ethics as to whether you hire the right person or not? If you hire people that are not qualified for the role because they cost the company less, is that a question related to ethics for the business? Could you or should you be fired for perhaps being hired with the wrong skills? Is that ethical, yes or no? And again, I'll leave you to debate that question. Well, now let's get into the main body of ethics. What is it? Ethics, also known as a moral philosophy, is a branch of philosophy that addresses questions about morality, that is, concepts such as good and evil, right and wrong, justice and virtue. And that quote comes from Wikipedia. So our framework for today's debate is 1, the law, 2, moral standards, and 3, appropriateness, right and wrong behavior, which we would translate to integrity. So our framework is 1, the law, 2, moral standards, and 3, appropriate behavior, integrity. Let's start with the system of law. The law is a system of rules, usually enforced through a set of institutions. Laws can shape or reflect politics, economics, and society in numerous ways, and serve as a primary social mediator of relations between people. And again, the source for this quote is Wikipedia. Let's look at ethics and morality. Morality is a sense of behavioral conduct that differentiates intentions, decisions, and actions between those that are good or right and those that are bad or wrong. And again, this source is Wikipedia. So ethics and the appropriate behavior. Well, this is the big question. What is ethical and what is appropriate? Today, we're going to discuss ethics and behavior in a couple of different scenarios. Business transactions and situations in the workplace. We're going to discuss some examples. We're going to share some perspectives on difficult ethical issues. We're going to consider values. And we're going to consider how to take action if you see something. So here are some quotes that have come from a website that I enjoy viewing, www.thinkexist.com, thinkexist.com. And here are some quotations on ethics and integrity. Integrity is doing the right thing, even if nobody is watching. Relativity applies to physics, not ethics. Never let your sense of morals get in the way of doing what's right. Winning isn't nice if you don't lose your integrity in the process. And I love those quotes because they very much set the stage. Now, let's look at an example, and that example where I was a part of the company. I was an executive helping lead the receivables and reserves area, which was about a $10 billion base of assets and about a $4.5 billion base of liabilities for the reserve side. Bernie Ebbers, former CEO, he was found guilty of securities fraud. He was found guilty of conspiracy and filing false financials. What was he sentenced to? Well, 25 years. And here are some of the quotations that were said in the Bernie Ebbers trial. Ebbers, slightly teary-eyed as he hugged his wife and stepdaughter. Federal prosecutors said Ebbers was motivated to commit fraud by pressure on the company's share price. Ebbers borrowed nearly $400 million with his WorldCom shares as collateral alone. And then looking at Scott Sullivan, WorldCom's former chief financial officer who reported to Bernie Ebbers, in court, Scott Sullivan said he acted under Ebbers' direction. He said that Ebbers intimidated him into committing fraud so that the company would meet Wall Street's expectations. So this is something that I want to share with you. When I was at WorldCom, which we changed our company name to MCI, and then through the emergence from bankruptcy, and once we did the financial restatement, the company was sold to Verizon. And so this business has been bought on by Verizon. MCI's guiding principles, there were top 10 principles, and we were guided by these as not only running the company, but this was something that filtered all the way through. And I'm going to refer to the top five, then the six through 10. So top five, number one, guiding principles for the company. One, build trust and credibility. Number two, respect for the individual. Number three, create a culture of open and honest communications. Number four, set the tone at the top. Number five, uphold the law. And at this stage, I think it's important that we stop. We've talked about the top five guiding principles for a significant company, a Fortune 100 company. Yes, number five, we didn't get to upholding the law until we got to number five. We talked about trust, credibility, the individual, creating a culture that was good and honest and open, setting the tone at the top, and then number five, we get to upholding the law. And I remember when this came out and we were rolling it out within the company, we looked at, oh my goodness, why was upholding the law number five? And this comes to the crux of the debate about ethics, business, integrity, and doing the right thing, where sometimes upholding the law is a minimum requirement. And to do the right thing and to be ethical, you have to go beyond that. You have to go to looking at the transaction and you have to looking at what's right. And sometimes upholding the law doesn't necessarily take you beyond a standard setting or a rules-based approach. So let's now look at the bottom five top guiding principles for this company. Number six, avoid conflicts of interest. Number seven, set metrics and report results accurately. Number eight, promote substance over form. Number nine, be loyal. And number 10, finally, do the right thing. And again, I find it very interesting that yes, number 10 was to do the right thing. And it's important that that is in your top guiding principles from an ethical perspective, because again, doing the right thing isn't necessarily abiding by the law. The law is a minimum set of standards for us in commerce and for us as a community. Doing the right thing is so, so important. So what should you do if faced with an ethical situation in your workplace? Well, at some point in your life, my sense will be you will face leadership, ethical and legal decisions in your life and in the workplace, what should you do? Well, a guiding set of questions and areas to look at, first and foremost, consider your values. Consider what you believe to be as your values. And these are your core DNA elements of how guiding you how you should do what you should do. Consider your response if the camera was videoing you, if the world was looking at you, if you were on TV. What would your response be if everybody in the world knew what you were doing, the decisions that you were making? And then consider your reaction being front page news. Think viral, think Facebook. And in today's world, so frequently your decisions, not only from a personal but a business perspective, somebody could put it into a place where it could be publicly held. We're each a product of our upbringing. We're each a product of our experiences and desires. And within this, as leaders of the business, if you are a leader, your effective forms of leadership can include leading by example. They can also include bullying. And they can also include dictatorship. And as a leader, you need to decide how to lead and how you want to be perceived by others. As a leader of a business or company, employees will look to you to define what is acceptable behavior. The top 10 guiding principles that we just talked about had set the tone at the top. A leader defines how people follow. When I was at WorldCom MCI Verizon, the new leader that came in was Michael Capellas, CEO. Michael Capellas came in after the fraud, and I remember one day where he came to the Alpharetta office here in Atlanta, and he came on a Friday. He canceled his day, and he realized that everybody was working tremendous hours, 7 days a week, and some of them 15 to 18 hours a day. And we were being given breakfast, lunch, and dinner by the company on site 7 days a week so that we could actually do our job and do things quickly. Michael Capellas stayed. And on the Saturday morning, he went round and actually pushed the cart, delivered the coffee and the donuts on a Saturday morning. And from a personal perspective, I remember him doing this, and the reaction from the employees was just fabulously significant. I don't know that Michael realized the full extent of the impact that he had on the motivation of employees, certainly those that reported to me and those that were in the building that I was in. But this was very, very significant. Now, by contrast, the former CEO of WorldCom, Bernie Ebbers, had stopped providing coffee to all employees to save money, while at the same time he was committing one of the largest frauds in the history of mankind. So that just gives you a very stark contrast. So unethical behavior, it really can succeed. And this is something that, as I teach MBA students, they're very shocked to find out. And studies show that people can convince others to take part in unethical behaviors and unethical activities because they use bully tactics. Bully tactics are very effective. They're good salespeople. They have that charisma. They often convince themselves and their followers that the end justifies the means. You know, if I can help you make $1 million or $100, I'll give you a share of that and we won't tell anyone. They convince you that the actions aren't that bad. And over time, little unethical behaviors can become practice and then more significant unethical behaviors. And then it can become leading into very, very significant areas. And they finally, they prey on the other person's weakness. Good leaders are good manipulators, and you need to be careful of that. So unethical behavior, are there degrees or levels of ethics? Can you have degrees of legality? Is it okay to steal just a little bit? Is it okay to be fraudulent just for a few dollars? Let's consider some examples and ask the question, is this legal? Is this ethical? Is this appropriate? And each time, if you're faced with a situation in the workplace, these are three elements that I teach my students to look at. The three areas: Is this legal? Is this ethical? Is this appropriate? So let's do some examples. Unethical behavior and examples. Speeding at 56 miles an hour if the speed limit is 55. Certainly it's illegal. Is it unethical? Is there really a whole lot of difference between driving at 56 miles an hour versus 54 miles an hour? Drinking alcohol when you're 20 years and 363 days old, when the alcohol requirement is to be 21 years old. Does that extra couple of days really make a whole lot of difference? It's illegal, but is it unethical? Seeing somebody drop a $5 bill and picking it up rather than giving it back to them, running down the hallway and saying, "Hey, I saw you dropped a $5 bill." Using your company's computer for personal use. That's company business assets, and you would be using it for personal use. Is that ethical? Not telling your friend if you find out his girlfriend is cheating. Not telling a coworker if you find out somebody is doing something inappropriate. Maybe not telling your boss. Not raising an issue if you see somebody in the business workplace expensing items that really are not business expenses. Is being quiet an example of an unethical behavior? Well, all these certainly bring in the debate about ethics. And these are some examples from my own experience. I had a boss one time, the CEO of a company. He was drinking alcohol in the workplace, and he actually was an alcoholic. He had a problem, and he would come into the main office and bring wine and pass it around and openly hand it out, and this was any day of the week. That was unethical. An individual that I worked for, in fact, this same situation, the alcohol that was being drunk wanted to be expensed and wanted it to be reimbursed. I've seen situations where a particular person wanted to buy goods on the business for his or her mistress. Somebody that was nothing to do with the company, somebody that was a personal relationship, and then to go and expense it. And then in the same situation, this particular example happened. Would you cover for me when my wife calls and tell her I'm in a business meeting when you know that that particular individual was somewhere they shouldn't have been? And the three questions I would ask you, are these legal? Are these ethical? Are these appropriate? And there's a different level of standard for each. Early on in my career, I was asked in an interview, do you have a boyfriend? And then I was asked, are you going to get married? And then the third question came then, because if you got married and you had a baby, we would have to pay you benefits if you had maternity leave. And this was in an interview that I had. Do you think I took that job based on the questions that were being asked to me? They were actually illegal for the country in which I was being asked. They definitely were unethical. And in my mind, they definitely were inappropriate. And I told the recruiter that I was not about to take that job. So again, from my own experiences, I had a boss one time that asked me to stand at the door and watch for anyone coming in while that person went through and rifled through the desk of the senior vice president's office materials, reading memos and other items that were on the desk, and they asked me to stand at the door and watch. I actually refused, and I sat down waiting in the hallway. Do you think I respected that person? There's a legal question here. There's an ethical question, and there's an appropriate question. Now, back to, again, my own experiences, and I'm going to draw upon WorldCom. In the first 6 weeks of working at WorldCom as a leader of the organization, I approved financial and accounting adjustments of $1.2 billion. And I was asked the question by my staff, why do you want to see the accounting reconciliations? Why is that important? And I would ask you the question, this was a company that went through bankruptcy. Is bankruptcy itself and the proceedings ethical? It certainly is legal. Is it something that's acceptable in business where we allow companies to be able to avoid some of their debts? another item, not hiring adequate resources to perform appropriate work and manage the appropriate functions. That was something that was done at WorldCom. They didn't have enough staff. They didn't have the right levels of staff. Is that ethical? And at what point do bad work practices become unethical behavior? And this is something as a manager and a leader in business, I think that you need to ask yourself the questions of legality, the question of what is ethical, and the question of appropriate. And here are some items that I would leave with you to consider. It's performance appraisal time, and you see a peer's folder on the desk marked confidential. You know that there's a strong likelihood that what is inside of that is to do with that person's pay raise. Maybe they're somebody that you would like to know what their pay salary was, their pay grade, but their file on the desk is marked confidential. Do you open it? Another example to consider, you're in a bid with a competitor and they leave a folder on the table as they leave the room. It looks as though it's got some very specific information in there that would give you pricing information and give you the ability to put in a better bid had you had that information. Do you read it and do you read the contents? Well, that particular one was actually an example of a company that I was with prior to my being there, and that particular file was left in the room deliberately, and it had incorrect information that would be put there to mislead that competitor. The competitor did actually read the file and they did actually include that in the bid process, and they lost the bid because the competition actually led them to do that, and they made a mistake. They followed it. So these are questions of legality and ethical and appropriate. And through some of the training that I have had, these have been questions that have been posed to me as a leader. Giving somebody a deadline of Monday at 9 a.m., I was advised in some training that I did by the Darden School of Business that it is not ethical to ask somebody to have something prepared, done by Monday 9 a.m. And what they've said is it's ethical to ask for it on Friday at 4 p.m. instead, whereas if you give somebody a deadline of Monday 9 a.m., they likely will work over the weekend on it. So here's another question from a business setting. You hold a meeting at 6 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. I've been in situations where I've had a working environment of 9 to 5 p.m. and I've been asked to attend meetings at 6 and 8 and 10 o'clock at night. Is that ethical? Then perhaps the question, your boss asks you to book an accounting entry and he, she doesn't provide any backup. You have no reason to suspect for fraud, but do you book the entry? What do you do? And again, I would ask you to look at the questions, is it legal? Is it ethical? Is it appropriate? Well, here are some examples that I've given you that really are intended to help you question your experiences, your background, what you see in the workplace and the challenges that you may have. And with that in mind, that information and that training presentation comes from Delaney Consulting LLC. It is part of the Delaney Learning Program, where we go into businesses and we go into universities and we provide this information. We do training around this. So I hope you enjoyed that article today. And with that in mind, I would like to get back to the CFO radio component and thank our contributors. Thank you to Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also go to National Association of Corporate Directors, Advancing Exemplary Board Leadership for Directors by Directors. You can see their website at www.nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one that you think would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. The email address to do so is info@cforadio.com. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chulvers signing off. Until next time.